Welcome to Get a Move On, the podcast for movement lovers who are fed up with their injuries and want to enhance their all-round health. On this podcast, I'll help you change how you think about pain and illness so you can drop the frustration and move freely. I'm Amy, an osteopath turned yoga teacher and mindset coach. On this pod, I'll be talking about the joys of pain, injury and illness, the mind-body connection, and how they relate to our movement practice so you can get a move on.
Hey everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of Get a Move On with Amy Slevin. Today we're talking about infatuation with teachers, something that happens a lot in movement and the related spiritual contexts. But before any of that, Ames, how are you?
I am feeling like a guru.
It's funny you say that, because gurus are a little bit what we're going to be talking about today. Can you sum up the problem specific to movement, if you can, of teachers and gurus and infatuations?
Well, basically, we have somebody in a position of power and someone who has amazing skills, particular knowledge, and therefore a sense of power or perceived power. And they're delivering information and they're standing up in front of a group of people. And we tend to put those people on a sort of pedestal. Sometimes that power can go to their heads. And sometimes that power or that position of power can make people infatuate with them and subordinate to them.
Yeah, and it's interesting because with movement, the people who are the teachers have more skills than you. And it's not just that they've got some arbitrary skill, they've developed a practice that you are really dedicated to at times. So they're sort of much higher up the mountain, and it's very much a mountain you're wanting to climb, which makes them very obvious figures for infatuation. You know, I had an experience where I was not a movement teacher, mind, but reasonably infatuated with a teacher of some kind. And then as soon as I stopped sort of buying what they were selling psychologically, the teacher themselves kind of evaporated. The air of wonder that I had around this teacher disappeared. And it was because I was no longer sort of playing the game. But the problem is, if you're a yogi, say, and you have a spiritual / yoga teacher who's got a massive practice, it's hard to untangle
that. Yeah. And especially if you perceive that person also as like in some way enlightened, because then you have like the double whammy of, oh my God, they can do this amazing stuff with their body. And they're also incredibly zen and they know something about the world. They've discovered some sense of themselves that we haven't. And we therefore revere that person.
Yeah. And it's easy to make the link between their physical abilities and their spiritual / emotional development. You almost go, and it sounds silly, I know. God, anyone who can do that pose for that long with that level of flexibility and poise, well, it makes sense that they're kind of an enlightened person. Like, they seem to support each other somehow.
Yeah, except the reality is a little bit different, of course. So we'll talk about that a bit later.
Have you ever had any infatuations with movement teachers?
Funny you should say that. I have had some infatuations with teachers. When I say teachers, I don't mean my school teachers or my university lecturers. I mean my movement teachers. Like, I've definitely felt like, oh my gosh, this person can do things better than I can. And, you know, some of them have been kind of charismatic and fun and funny. And that's pretty attractive, you know, on a human level, regardless of whether or not they're a movement teacher as well. And I've also been in a situation where, you know, I've known this person for a long time and we've both been single and free agents. And then, you know, there's been a little bit of cheeky something something happening.
Yeah, I think the difficulty lots of teachers run into is the power dynamic. Because it seems obvious there that there's a power imbalance. And on the one hand, like, well, you're an adult and you're a free agent. But on the other, you're very much buying what they're selling. And as far as I take practice X very seriously, they're a master practitioner of X. But all of a sudden, it's hard to see that as two equal parties meeting.
Yeah. Although, ironically, at the time, I definitely felt like it was two parties meeting equally. And I still, if I look back on it now, it definitely was. But that was for me. And other people who've been in similar situations may not perceive their situation as the same. But I'm just saying that was my experience. I went in there knowing exactly what was going on. I actually had a sense of power over them, in a sense, kind of like knowing that this person had kind of fancied me for ages and I'd never entertained it, and then suddenly I did, and then I was like, I am all powerful. Except the irony is that in that moment where I let my guard down, I lost my power.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting take, because obviously the power sounds like it's in the hands, and often is, I'd imagine, if I was guessing, of the teacher or the one holding the power. There probably is something in it for the student who's sleeping with an all-powerful teacher, because now all of a sudden, if they're so wonderful and they're into me, maybe I'm so wonderful.
Oh, for sure. That power rubs off on you. I was kind of okay with the situation. I felt disappointed with myself and kind of let down that I kind of relinquished my power. And I was still okay with it until I discovered that there were lots of other girls who had had a similar experience to me with the same person. And then suddenly, my kind of exclusivity and my specialness with this person immediately diminished my perceptions. And that's when my perceptions of the whole encounter changed and I didn't like it anymore. And that's when I kind of thought, oh no. It was more like I felt like an idiot rather than something bad has happened to me.
Yeah, and the fact that the exclusivity was so important in how you perceive the situation shows in part what the teachers are doing and what you're getting out of it, which is they are effectively utilizing the dynamic such that it's quite exciting to have that exclusivity.
Totally. You feel so special and kind of singled out in a way, like, you know, that they've seen something in you that is kind of unique and wonderful, that because they're a teacher, sometimes, not necessarily, is even more special that they recognize that. I mean, should we talk about Matt Hancock?
Let's talk about Matt Hancock. Let's do it.
Okay, well, look, he's a dweeb. You know, he's like a bumbling idiot in a position of power, and he's not sexy, except for the fact that he's in a position of power.
Yeah, he's also, beyond not being sexy, he's also just not very good at health policy. Which is a problem, presumably, for a man who works in health policy. But you're right, like, clearly there's a dynamic there. But that's actually a good example, Matt Hancock, because I think one of the reasons people are so offended by that, beyond the fact it was taxpayers' money and a conflict of interests and breaking the rules that he made and the fact that he's married and the fact he has two kids, if you leave all of those small details...
He's just not sexy.
Well, there's definitely that, but there's also the fact that I think people detect a power imbalance. Anyway, yeah. I think I want to move this to what people can do when they're in a yoga class, say, or a parkour class, and they're like, oh shit, I'm infatuated, not even necessarily romantically, but I'm infatuated with this teacher in a way that probably isn't helpful to my practice or my self-esteem or my anything else.
I think the trouble is that most people don't know that they're infatuated. Most people don't know that they're in a state of revering the teacher.
How can you tell?
Well, I think you can tell if you want the teacher's attention is sometimes a thing. If you are kind of seeking interactions with that teacher outside the classroom, not always, but, you know, that sometimes can be a bit of a sign. Like if you particularly want the teacher to give you adjustments, or if you're kind of secretly, either consciously or unconsciously, trying to get the teacher to interact with you in a particular way, that if you're in a different teacher's class, would you still want their attention that much?
Probably not. And your emotions, I think, probably serve as decent feedback here too, where the, oh my God, they spoke to me. When that becomes slightly too exciting, you know, you potentially have an issue.
Yeah. Oh my God, eye contact. Although we shouldn't say that about eye contact. I love making eye contact with all my students.
So if you're listening, students, Amy's into you.
All of them.
All of you.
I'm so into them. No, but that one, for me, I get high on the human contact.
Okay, well, that's an interesting thing. Do you think some teachers in part aspire to be teachers because they have this dynamic, this power imbalance that basically can end up meaning that people want to shag them?
That's an interesting question. I think probably doesn't start out that way, because I think, you know, if your agenda is to get laid, you're not necessarily going to choose that route. There are much simpler routes to that. If you are seeking power, yeah, that is a way. But there are lots of routes to the same end.
It's almost as if you're implying that spending 20 years mastering yoga isn't the most direct route to getting laid.
No, but it definitely is a perk.
Okay, and so let's paint the picture. Someone sitting in the back of their yoga class thinking, shit, this teacher isn't only articulate and attractive and skilled, he's also enlightened and whatever else. And I'm infatuated with him and I'm fighting subconsciously for his attention, etc., etc., etc. What should you do?
I would strongly recommend that you bring to your mind the specific things that you think are amazing about that teacher or that person. The specific things that you think that they can do better than you can. And then think, okay, well, hold on. What are the specific traits that this person has that you perceive they have more than you have? So for example, if you're saying like charisma, charisma can be like big, fat, bubbly vibes. It can also be like really quiet, slow speaking, which I think our father sometimes does. So if you get really clear on the specific traits that you think that person has more than you do, and then look for when they do the opposite. Okay, so when did that person not have charisma? When did that person, I don't know, do something ugly? Or in what ways is that person ugly? And it can be really hard to do that when you're so infatuated.
It's almost as if you're making sort of a deeper claim here about the mechanics of infatuation, which is basically to say infatuation is that person over there who I'm infatuating with has some desirable trait way more than me. And I can't see the ways in which they don't have that thing. So I see that person as all charismatic and I'm relatively uncharismatic and that gap is infatuation.
Yeah. And they know stuff that I don't know. And I think in that situation, and I've come across that not so much as like people like revering me so much, but just they get a bit overwhelmed thinking, oh my God, I can never do what you can do. And I say this to my students in those moments where that happens. I'm like, you can do things in your life that I can't do. I've spent hours mastering all of this stuff. And there are things that you've put the same equivalent amount of time in because that's important to you. Those things that you are a master of, I'm shit at.
It's an interesting point because mastery is obviously relative to discipline. And when we see people as amazing yoga practitioners, we rarely go, oh, you know, you're amazing, but you're kind of amazing in this domain. We go, oh my God, you're amazing.
Yeah.
And we're not conscious of the fact, well, actually, I'm pretty good at X, Y, Z.
Exactly.
Which they have no skills in.
Yeah. And I definitely invite them to be very conscious of my ineptitudes and how they are stronger in my ineptitudes than I am.
Do you find that you're conscious? I mean, having taught a lot of movement and pain stuff, are you a different pupil than you used to be when you're in other people's classes?
Oh my God, I'm so intolerant. I'm really intolerant. It kind of depends on the teacher. If the teacher is humble, so for example, my handstand teacher is hilarious. I love him. And he has humility, like he takes the piss out of himself. He's so good at what he does. So with him, I'm not quite so intolerant. When I say I'm not quite so intolerant, there's nothing to tolerate. But then like with other yoga teachers, especially the ones who just kind of like prance around the room like they're a god, I'm just like, fuck off.
Yoga, because it's obviously once upon a time was effectively entirely a spiritual game. And now it's more of a movement game in the West. Although depending on who you talk to, it can be certainly all shades of both. Is it a discipline that lends itself to gurus, infatuations, and all of this stuff more so than other movement disciplines?
Good question.
Because I know certainly if you look at things that are only in my mind divorced from yoga a little, at least in the more spiritual end of things, like meditation, that's an industry where like every 6 months some top guru is outed for sexually assaulting 8 of their students and are quickly shunned by the community, enter next guru. And I just wonder if some things are just set up to be hierarchical.
I mean, look, the same thing happens with university lecturers too, right? And in the church, is it in the church? Maybe we shouldn't have said that. Let's not go there. Let's not talk about the church. But yeah, is it a yoga thing? Or is it just the fact that yoga is deemed to be, and you know, the more kind of holy or technically good something sells itself as, when there is such a scandal, then it's, you know, really awful. Whereas like in context, say for example, if Berlusconi, president of Italy, ex-president of Italy, is found to be having an affair, no one really cares because they're not pretending to be so amazing and so holy.
Yeah, there's something about like you know, shock as DJ sleeps with promoter isn't a sentence that anyone's ever said.
No, I mean, look, that happens every night, presumably.
Presumably somewhere for someone.
Yeah.
No, it's an interesting thing. And I think a lot of people who go into the spiritual side of yoga do have to weigh this thing up, because obviously it is a good quote unquote thing, which leads inevitably to some level of repression, because for something to be self-proclaimed good, there has to be some mm-hmm. condemnation of what is bad.
Yeah.
And most people kind of have everything. And if you repress it, it sort of comes out in slightly strange ways.
Yeah.
So I wonder if the gooder the community, the more pressure.
Sure. Definitely. Which is why, you know, all the kind of the scandals, the sexual scandals in the church are so awful. It's because, well, partly because they are pretty bad, but also because it's like, it's the church who sell holiness and goodness. And then suddenly, oops, they're being human. And we don't like to acknowledge the human side. And I think that's also what happens with the yoga gurus. You know, they are human. And being human, we all have every personality trait and every behavior in our own form. And we can't get rid of ourselves. The more we try to suppress something, it's going to become expressed in a different form.
Interesting. How so?
Well, priests, and this is a quite extreme example, but, you know, technically, they're not allowed to have sex. And because they're not allowed to have sex, I think that is partly why they choose to express their natural sexual urge that exists in them, as it exists in all of us, with a child. It's because, you know, they know that the child is less likely to cause a ruckus and judge them. Mostly, I think that's what it's about. So the child is less likely to judge them as bad in the moment, because the child doesn't have that sense of, you're a priest, you're not supposed to have sex, whereas an adult probably does. I don't know if that's exactly accurate, but I think there's something about that that's like, you know, the judgment is different.
Yeah, there is some analogy about things being forced underground. You know, when you ban selling alcohol in America, as they did during the Prohibition, all you effectively did was have people go to the black market.
And,
yeah, and one of the problems with Ireland and their laws on abortion is, of course, abortions still happen.
It's just they just come over here.
Yeah, they either come over here or abortions happen underground, both of which are obviously unideal. And, you know, so I understand what you mean. And maybe that's one of the issues with communities in general that proclaim themselves to be holier than thou.
The more taboo something is, the more exciting and enticing and desirable it becomes. And so the more we try to repress something and pretend that we don't want it or make it bad, the more we're drawing in people who are going to want it and get excited by it.
I think that's probably right. And it explains why, in some kind of strange way, and I only say this because I've just finished watching Casino, which is one of those 1990s or 1980s gangster films. In a weird way, you kind of like the characters who are just very honest with themselves.
Yeah, and the ones who, you know, they're like, I am human, I'm as fallible as the rest of you.
Yeah, and there's a complexity, which even though we go, God, I'm not sure I like that character, he's clearly doing horribly nasty things. When you then see them with their family and they're being lovely, there's something about the complexity we appreciate or feel slightly more relaxed about ourselves in the context of, because we know we're great in some ways and shit in other ways. And that level of complexity kind of makes you feel a bit more at home. And I think it's mm-hmm. also why I think everyone calls bullshit on people who walk around with a little bit of a halo. Because of course, they don't have one.
Yeah.
In true Get a Move On spirit, that.
The more honest we are with ourselves about the fact that we have good and bad and generous and stingy and kind and cruel or kind and mean or all the other complementary opposites. And I think there's a real thing in like personal development of we must only ever be the nice things. And that also is not just personal development. It's like, you know, religion, society kind of, you know, tries to get everyone to be only ever the positive stuff. That's not realistic. That's setting everybody up for failure. And the more we can just acknowledge the fact that we do have the mean, bullying, cruel, aggressive, angry, the things that we don't desire, and just own them and just be like, yo, this is me. Then everything just calms down, because you're not trying to be someone that you're not. You're not trying to be this one-sided person. You're just like, sometimes I'm a dickhead.
Yeah. And if you look at figures historically who we think of as genuinely like game-changing people for the good.
Margaret and Thatcher. You can go
for potentially Margaret Thatcher. I say kind of through incredibly gritted teeth. I was going to say less controversially and much more cliched. Nelson Mandela had a very complex relationship with Winnie and was basically a bad dude in lots of ways. Gandhi fought for the freedom and liberation of the Indian people. He was also racist in very many obvious ways. And even people who we think of as like historically and titanically brilliant, like very quickly, you know, because they're public figures, their dark side gets revealed.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a few places to take this conversation. But like, you know, Carl Jung was very into integrating the shadow side. That's how he puts it.
I was going to say, like, Donald Trump is another example. I think Donald Trump is someone he's a very divisive character, but he's loved and hated equally for the same traits. Some people will perceive his kind of go-getting, America is the best thing ever, we're going to make America great again. Some people are going to love that and perceive that as amazing, whereas others are going to be like, oh my God, don't be ridiculous.
Yeah, what some people see is brash and not fit to be president and unthoughtful. Other people see as straightforward, real talking.
Yeah.
And I would suggest that the latter half are wrong, but I understand the wider point that you're making is people will love and dislike the same traits. It just depends who you ask. And I think that's generally true. There's very few figures who aren't divisive if you really think about it. Like Marilyn Monroe is thought of in some corners as being the epitome of 20th century beauty, elegant, etc., etc. Or if you ask other people, they'll say Marilyn Monroe, oh, and think of her as very defined by her superficiality and everything else. And I think that's probably true the whole way through.
Yeah. And she's, I guess, you know, there were some people who could say that she epitomizes the nonsense of American propaganda and Hollywood nonsense as well, and dislike her for that too.
Yeah, aspiration and greed, pragmatism and selling out, these are all different views on the exact same trait. Like Barack Obama gets a lot of stick from the left in the States, as does Mandela from what I'll call the left in South Africa. And the accusation both times is you didn't go nearly far enough. But other people, and I probably am in this category, I have to say, go Obama / Mandela, like, oh, like brilliantly, pragmatically progressive, big changes, blah, blah, blah. But the same trait that I'm seeing, I'm leaning on the pragmatism there. I'm basically into the lack of revolutionary zest, whereas lots of people look at that and think that is just totally opposed to the point of politics. Yeah, so we've sort of started with the relationship between teachers and infatuation, especially in the movement context, and kind of wandered down the path of integrating your dark side and the idea that probably repression comes in most cases from a need to be all good, all holy, all et cetera, et cetera. That was a ride.
Yeah, and also the need of the student to feel a particular way.
Yeah, which is interesting, right? And that's why the power dynamic, I think, probably is in the first instance an issue.
I think that students of any discipline, whether it's at school, university, in a movement context, would probably do well to just keep their teachers in check and remember all the bad things about the teacher and try to see them as a human being rather than a god.
Which is all too easy to do.
Mm-hmm.
All right, listen, thank you so much for listening to this winding, roaming episode of Get to Move On with Jamie 7. I'm Jamie, and as always, we'll see you next week.
Amazing.
That was Get to Move On with Amy Slevin. If you enjoyed that, we'll be back next week with a slightly different topic. And if you didn't enjoy that, we'll be back next week with a slightly different topic. Thanks for listening.